She does not get a call from God to marry, period. She might ask the Lord, marry what? Marry whom? Marry how? Nor does she receive a vocation to marry, well, the male species. How specific can you get when a couple, after a year or more of courtship, decide to take each other for better or for worse? They're expecting the better. The old learn soon that it is also for worse. If then, as we know, a married vocation is as specific as you can get, this person marries that person and nobody else. Correspondingly, no one receives a vocation to the religious life, period. The vocation and part of its construct, part of its divine pattern, is that it be to a specific community. Why is this important to stress? And why do I wish to bring it out here so that you in your days of reflection and decision will recognize that there are different communities in the church? You are one of them. Make sure that yours is identifiable. There are different forms of apostolate. You have yours. Others have theirs. There are different approaches to the following of Christ. As much as I admire St. Francis immensely, I know that Ignatius was not Francis. For one thing, you can correct me, I don't believe Francis of Assisi ever wielded a sword. Is that correct? Ignatius did. Ignatius, in his earlier days, also carried a gun. So there are different ways of following Christ. There are different persons with different personalities and temperaments. A person, therefore, may have a religious vocation, but not to any community. No more, as we said, than a woman who has a vocation to marriage could be said to be called to marry anyone, and much less everyone. A mistake here would be very serious. What does it point up? It points up two things that I'd like to share with you as my closing observation. First of all, it points up the grave need on the part of the community, especially its leaders. And I think I'm speaking to the right people to know who they are, what is their spirit, what is their purpose, what were they, what do they wish to be, and what might be even more important, what were they not, what do they not wish to be. In order that the Spirit of Christ, calling, as I'm sure you are hoping, hundreds of young men in the years to come to your ranks, that he will have something to offer them which they can respond to with generosity, but also with a shrewdness, especially of modern youth. They know what they want, and they want you to be sure you know what you are offering them. And secondly, it is important to emphasize this distinctiveness of the community, in order that on the part of the prospective members, wise choice will be made, that your process of formation be geared to correspond with the spirit which you have, and that you will not experience what so many communities have experienced: large numbers of people wandering and wondering whether the community they entered was the one in which they belonged. For this, we all need divine guidance. I am sure the Holy Spirit will assist you to spell out. I am now on the third dimension. As much as you can now, or set the process in motion for spelling out into the future, both what kind of a community you are and wish to be, and the kind of people whom you hope to have respond to the vocation you wonder God will offer them. I might close by saying that I offered my Mass this morning for the chapter and your deliberations. Thanks again, sisters, for listening. Sisters, if I may mention, I told Mother I have made arrangements to stay here through the day if I can be of service, okay? I have classes on Monday. In fact, our classes begin, unfortunately, on the 2nd of October. We begin late classes around the quarter system. So I will not be leaving until tomorrow, and consequently, any private discussion or any caucus you might wish to engage in, informally or otherwise, I'll try to cover these questions. Okay. Speaking to the subject of corporate prayer, in your experience, have you found a definite relationship between the use or abuse of television to the neglect of personal and corporate prayer life? Yes. I think television is one of the great discoveries, one of the greatest discoveries of man. Properly used, it has a lot to offer. But I honestly believe that the use of the media and television is one. The same can apply to reading, all kinds of things that our modern age provides us with. It is possible to become addicted, and I don't hesitate using the verb. Would you agree? That was brought home to me when a priest told me, he said, you know, it's awful hard to say your office while watching television. Well, of course, I agreed with him. I was finding hard, too. I might say much more, but let me leave it there. For many communities, to have benediction and special devotions is a thing of the past. Should we continue with them or not? But you know what I thought, between having come here and this moment? Several times I asked myself, will the chapter, sometime before it concludes, have a benediction? Is it on the agenda? Is it? Great. Keep it up. Now, the question, however, is benediction and special devotions a thing of the past? For some people, of course, it is a thing of the past. But remember, there are things which are objectively past and things which are subjectively past. Subjectively and psychologically, there are a lot of things which are authentically Catholic, which have become, I repeat, subjectively in people's minds, things of the past. I don't hesitate saying, it is only a matter of time when such people will also believe that Catholicism is a thing of the past. As one who teaches religion, just religion, professionally, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and also Christianity, I don't hesitate saying, and it's a simple fact, all religions practice devotions. One of my many definitions of religion is, it is a system of thought which has devotional life as its expression. Divorce devotion from religion, and religion becomes a cerebral philosophy. I might add, by the way, teaching as I do at the University of Chicago, that's where we are. I am surrounded by a cerebral society. For some sisters, the habit seems to be a security blanket. That has at least three meanings. And they consider themselves good religious as long as they wear it, like it always was. Do you think that the uniformity in clothes contributes to union in community? And added, I do believe in a religious identification. Well, no doubt. There are and have been people for whom the habit was a security blanket, with all possible connotations. There are people who entered Vedija's life to find themselves in protective spiritual custody, safe from the world and its evils, and protected from the temptations which they knew were in the world. But after we say all of that, and after we describe all sorts of people, sometimes normal, sometimes abnormal, and we know that religious life has its share of abnormalities. When we, however, address ourselves to the question of the habit, it's not only the habit, it's anything in the faith or in religious life which can be abused. We are touching on what I mentioned this morning, one of the substantials in the mind of the church. Consequently, wearing a habit is not an eccentricity. It is not a security blanket. I think a good description of the purpose of the religious habit, especially for women, because that's the context in which the statement was made by the Consiliar Commission on the Religious Life during the sessions of the Second Vatican Council, in answer to the objection that wearing a habit seemed to be giving in to a bizarre kind of Manichaeism, where the human body was somehow considered evil, and the thing to do was to cover as much of it as possible. Well, the response of the commission was, and I quote, "The purpose of the religious habits is to express and protect the religious character of those who are in the religious life." To express and protect the religious character. By now we know what happens when the religious habit is shed. As I've been told by so many who have done so, often naively, sometimes under some kind of coercion, first I begin to think of myself as a secular, then I begin to think like a secular, and then I act like a secular. Now the question of uniformity is asked, do I think that uniformity in clothes contributes to union in community? Well, if it doesn't, it should. Provided, and this is a very important proviso, provided those who are in that community have thought through and convinced themselves that this is what they want. Because, you know, it's one thing to have a uniform habit of clothes. It is another thing to share the same spiritual convictions and ideals. What is your explanation of group living as currently practiced in many religious groups? I'm not speaking even of those living in apartments. Well, group living, as you know, can mean a lot of things. It can mean living, say, in apartments. It can mean that a group decides that they want to live among themselves. In other words, that the group is a group of its own choice. a group may mean that there is a small number, designedly. A group may mean that it's both a small group and that they lack the variety because they are small, and the diversity of personalities and responsibilities which a larger community implies. First of all, group living, properly understood, is of the essence of religious life. As I discovered when I entered the community which I joined, I was orphaned at the age of 1. My father died at the age of 26. The only child, mother never remarried. I finished my university education before I entered the Jesuits. And if there was ever an arch-individualist, it was me. So I discovered in the first week that I either would settle for group living or I couldn't make it. I might add, however, sisters, that terms are now being used either to camouflage or to color certain ideas which the words do not really express. Within a group, there must be community of spirit. Otherwise, people will seek ways of living with kindred spirits, as they say, in order to find such legitimate expression for their affections and emotions and freedom of communication that we all need. But this is part of the homework I suggest, that you have to ensure that community life is such that people will not be coining words to create new forms, that isn't the word, to create competitive forms of living together to what should be satisfied by solid, loving community life. Please explain the terms subsidiarity and collegiality, and how can they be actively used in religious communities? You won't mind my saying this, sisters. I can see these questions are not being submitted by amateurs. And since there are many questions, now may I ask, maybe for your reaction, would it be better for me, now maybe if I put the question one way, you'll answer it just that way, to spend a good deal of time on certain questions, or should we, maybe if we don't answer them all, and then maybe hopefully pick up in some other situation questions that I don't cover. This is a very important question. Let me spend not too much time on it. Subsidiarity and collegiality are not the same thing. That's the first thing to say. Subsidiarity is essentially a technique, and it pertains to all forms of organized living, or better, all kinds of corporate enterprise, where the essence of subsidiarity is that a higher authority, and this could be General Motors, Procter Gamble, or your community, where the higher authority will not do or undertake to do what a lower authority, being closer to the scene and more familiar with the needs, can handle as well or better. Is that clear? That's the essence of subsidiarity. I might see as the essence of corporate common sense. And I'm sure you don't mind my telling you that it is very wise to have major superiors who know how to delegate, and then who will trust those whom they delegated authority to carry out the enterprise. Collegiality is a uniquely ecclesiastical term. In fact, it's a revealed term. It was not discovered by the Second Vatican Council. It was created by Christ our Lord. The first exercise of collegiality was when Christ collegiate, or collexi, depending on what tense you want to use, the 12 apostles. The first collegium was the 12 apostles. What is collegiality? In the Catholic Church, collegiality is the exercise of the Church's authority on all of its levels, where the successors of the apostles, in union with the successor of the head of the apostles, together do the corporate work of sanctifying and saving mankind. So it's the cooperative working of the hierarchy in union with the Bishop of Rome. Now, since every segment of the Church, in a way, is the Church in microcosm, no less than in the Church at large, things are to be done together, always recognizing that there is the highest authority, which makes the collectivity, the collegium, even exist. The bishops, though they are validly consecrated, do you know they've got no authority in the Catholic Church? Zero authority in the Catholic Church. The moment they break with the Bishop of Rome, they don't cease to be bishops. They've lost all rights to direct anybody the moment they break with Rome. And they have authority to direct only insofar as they are in union with their fellow bishops and the Bishop of Rome. Now, what the Second Vatican Council has done, and hence the term collegiality, which is so much now in our modern literature, what it has done is brought to the surface what was always there, namely, the need for cooperative labors, so that, for example, speaking of the universal church, the Pope alone will not, though he always has the right to, well, legislate or direct the workings of each, for example, diocese, to give the bishops, individually in their diocese, collectively in a nation, not give them the right to tell them, you should exercise your authority within this ambit, in union with the rest of your hierarchy and in other parts of the world, and in union with Rome, but you do your work cooperatively, collectively, always keeping in mind that the collectivity cannot be schismatic. Am I clear? It cannot be a separate caucus. There cannot be an American Catholic Church which does its thing independent of, and less still, in contradiction to, what the Universal Church is doing in union with Rome. of the religious communities, I would say collegiality means that those who are superiors, whether major or I guess you might call them minor, is that the right word? Local is a better term. We don't like to use the word minor. Major and local superiors, that they recognize, the major superiors, that a lot of things can be done, for example, in the local community. This would be subsidiarity, which they don't have to directly enter, and that there are certain things that can be done by, you might say, the grassroots, living out of the spirit, where certain things will come to the surface. Now, this is what the community really wants and stands for, and therefore, provided it is consistent with the spirit of your community and in obedience to the Catholic Church, should be respected, and if, as in this case, you have the authority to do it, to legislate it. The best example of collegiality in religious life is this chapter. That's why you're meeting. How can sisters see corporate community being implemented when administrative sisters, I guess, make members in the community feel they are no longer wanted or needed?